court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia.
Perspective on legal philosophy. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude.
Well, in case you couldn't tell out there in podcast land, I'm a little stopped up still for my cold.
Yeah, delayed us getting in the recording studio because you were really under the weather a few days ago.
Yeah, I was. I don't know. I don't get sick too often, but this one really, really knocked it out of me.
It's that new exposure you're getting to kid germs. Kids are little germ manufacturing machines, and you're getting those germs being brought home to you from your school teacher friend.
Yeah, probably so. Kids are germ magnets. I've always heard that, but I can attest to it firsthand now.
They're germy, nasty little beings.
The worst thing was that I had a really busy week at work, and I couldn't really miss work. So I was going to court sick in the mornings and then coming limping home about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, just crawling to bed.
Well, I'm glad you're at least recovered enough to get us in here in just enough time to try to get this put out for Monday.
Yeah.
Can't miss our deadline. We'll get fined or something.
Well, no, our deadlines actually would be all the way till the next Sunday.
Well, I know, but we want to strive for consistency. That's one of the important things in a podcast, consistency.
It is. So consistency and location.
We try to be consistent. Location. Is that the other one?
I don't know.
Yeah, on iTunes.
This episode is one that I don't think anybody suggested this one because this is not one that probably, unless you're a lawyer, you're even familiar with, but it is something that is very important in the practice of law, especially litigation, and that is discovery.
Oh, I watch that channel.
No, it's not like the channel. It's not like finding Bigfoot or whatever's on the Discovery Channel these days.
Look for Sasquatch.
Yeah. Discovery is basically a pretrial procedure in whenever you have a lawsuit, and each party basically gives information and evidence to the other party after it's requested. And sometimes it's actually an automatic disclosure. And there's different methods for discovery, different kind of tools. One way it was always taught to me was like these are different tools you have in your toolbox as an attorney. So sometimes you take out, you know, your
hammer.
Yeah. Or your hammer. Or your screwdriver, or your request for production of documents.
Or your drill.
But no, basically, these are all just different tools you have to try to learn different things about the lawsuit. And basically, you open up your tool chest and say, all right, let's get to work. Now, discovery itself is very boring, and not many attorneys like to do it, myself included. But it is a very important part of it, because what it does is it allows you to get a good picture of your opponent's case before trial. So,
well, now the one thing that I was kind of taken aback when I did my preparation for this, because I'm always well prepared, at least I show up anyway.
It's half the battle.
That's right. 98% of success is just showing up. It said lawsuit. Do they not have discovery in criminal cases?
No, they do.
Okay. Well, the way it was written is in the definitions that I looked up, discovery, it kept referring to lawsuits. And to me, lawsuits are civil. And, you know, then you also have criminal, which we've gone over before. And so I thought, well, I know there's got to be discovery in criminal because I've heard you refer to it before.
Yeah.
That, like, the prosecution, if they have stuff, they've got to turn it over to the defense attorney.
Yeah. That's one of the, whenever I get a criminal case, there's a whole slew of motions I file right from the get-go. And one of them is a request for discovery. And that's just basically to get the state to provide me the information they have they're going to use to try to prosecute my client.
Okay. So I just wanted to double check that because like you said, for getting ready for a lawsuit, it sounds like discovery is just pertaining to civil suits.
Now, it's different in West Virginia for criminal law because generally there's not depositions in criminal law in West Virginia. Whereas in Florida, in criminal law, you actually do have depositions. So now you can take them, I think, in West Virginia for good cause if you have some sort of reason, but it's not provided for in the rule as a general right. So
one of the things that I read too, and I don't know if you you are familiar with this or not, but it said that the discovery rule in general that is invoked under American law is unique to what discovery is in the rest of the world.
Well, it used to be that there was no discovery. And basically what that meant was that you said, hey, I'm suing you. And the person said, all right, I disagree with that. Let's have a trial. And you just went to the courthouse and had a trial. And that was considered a trial by ambush. And so the whole discovery idea is basically, well, I think it's kind of twofold, is that basically it levels the playing field so everybody knows what the other side has. And it also tries to streamline the process and maybe not stress the courts as much, because if everybody knows what the other side has, the theory is they might be more inclined to settle the case rather than litigate it, because it's like, well, level heads prevail here. We can see that you're obviously have a pretty strong case here. I should probably try to settle it to minimize my exposure. So okay. One law review article I saw had a, whenever people write for law review articles, they always try to come up with clever nicknames for their article. And this one's called Trial by Ambush or Avalanche. And the reason that's kind of funny is because one practice that's kind of common actually is when you do a request for discovery is that they actually give you everything and the kitchen sink. It's like, oh, you want to know what's going on? Well, here's five boxes. Good luck trying to find it.
So bury the important stuff within a bunch of stuff that's not important.
Yep. And also what it does is it causes that party to have to pay their attorney to go through it. And so it can basically become, a discovery can actually become a war of attrition, where spending money to just go through piles and piles of discovery and just going back and forth fighting over discovery. So,
well, that's one of the things that I read, that it said that one of the drawbacks of discovery, while yes, it can be good, that it has criticized as favoring the wealthier side, and not necessarily money, but information wise.
Yeah.
And it said that with the noble sentiment of leveling the playing field so that no party has an undue information advantage, the writers of the discovery rules created a multi-level playing field where the information rich can kick the information poor in the head and escape unscathed. Discovery is anything but. Hundreds of thousands of dollars to maintain the status quo, to preserve the information rich at the expense of the information poor. Thousands of lawyer hours to keep the discovery process as unrevealing as possible. The best minds of a generation thinking of new ways to manipulate, distort, and conceal. So in other words, they're saying that a lot of lawyers, they spend their time not trying to actually cooperate with discovery, but ways to cover up discovery and withhold discovery and stuff.
Well, it's happened to me before where I'm going to go through these different things and explain in a bit more detail what they are, but I'll send like an interrogatory, which is like a question, and the person will say, well, they'll nitpick the way it's phrased with one little thing. And it's like, oh, well, that's ambiguous because of this. That's like, come on, guy. You know, you and I both know well what we're talking about here. And I see where there is a point where you want to make sure that it doesn't hurt your client, but also at a certain point, it's just kind of being nitpicky and you're basically just making somebody jump through every hoop, which I've been guilty of that too. I mean, I've had clients who have said, look, Mike, I really don't care how much we spend on this case. I don't want to cooperate with them in any instant. And I said, you are my favorite client. Just make sure you keep paying the bill.
And that's exactly what they're saying. The criticism of it is.
Yeah.
Is that it doesn't. And maybe that's why other countries don't have discovery as part of their process.
I mean, that could be part of the reason. And I think the whole idea of discovery is the right idea. And I don't really know how to rein it in.
In other words, it's a great idea in theory. But like everything else, if there's a way to get around it, somebody will find it.
Well, and it becomes very contentious because you got to think litigation is an adversarial procedure. So,
and you don't care about what's right and wrong, really.
Adversarial process.
You just want to win.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, you want to win, especially in civil litigation, you know, much more, kind of much more cutthroat in certain instances.
Well, usually in most cases, somebody is really pissed off.
Yeah.
And they're wanting to get their pound of flesh out of somebody. And that's why the lawsuit was initiated.
Yeah, for the most part. And some of the worst ones I've ever had have been business breakups where two partners have kind of split up or things like that, because that can be just as bitter as a divorce, except it's supposed to be, you know, non non-domestic, non-family, but it's got all the...
Non-emotional.
Yeah, but it's got all the emotion of a divorce.
Yeah.
You have these partners who've worked together for years to build something, and now you're trying to split it up, so...
And probably in most cases, both of the partners feel like they're the ones that did the majority of the work.
So typically the way discovery is initiated in civil cases, and I'm not really going to talk about criminal because really I think civil discovery is a bit more interesting than criminal discovery. What happens is somebody will file a lawsuit or complaint, and then the person will file an answer. And then at that point, they will generally proceed to discovery. And discovery is just the whole process, like I said, of these different tools you try to use. So, I mean, sometimes when you file a lawsuit, you can actually send over a discovery request with the initial complaint, too, to go ahead and get the ball rolling on it. And the different things you can have for discovery is you can have depositions. And a deposition is essentially just where you subpoena a witness to take their testimony, and there's a court reporter there, and they're sworn in. But there's no judge, there's no judge present or anything like that. It's basically just a chance for you to depose somebody and ask them questions on the record. And the questions you can ask them are much broader in a deposition, because if it's possible to lead to discoverable evidence, so basically if the question I ask them is possible to lead to discoverable evidence, then I can ask it, even though it might not seem like it has any kind of real
relevance to the case.
Yeah, real relevance to the case. If I can make some sort of justification that it might lead to discoverable evidence somewhere, then I can ask that question.
Whereas if you were in court, you couldn't really do that.
No, it has to be right on point as to why you're asking that question. So depositions are something that happen in civil cases. I've been through probably at this point thousands of depositions. they can be interesting and they can be boring. Some of the most boring ones I ever did when I was a work comp attorney, the company's attorney would sit there and just ask some questions about like how they got hurt and get their job history and how they've ever been hurt in the past and what their daily activities consist of.
And have they had safety training?
Yeah. I mean, it was all I could do to not fall asleep in these things because they were so boring. And you can make objections in these things too if they ask a question that's improper. But
yeah, I've been deposed before.
Yeah, I think you told me that.
Yeah. So I've been through that process. Now, the one thing that I was never clear on, when they finish with your deposition and they've got it all transcribed and everything, does it just get entered into as evidence into the case? Or is it that they can review it and decide whether to call you as a witness in the case or not?
Well, I mean, it can be entered into evidence as well. Basically, it can be used for impeachment purposes is one of the main things that happens. So basically, if you give inconsistent testimony, then they can impeach you with what you said before. They can also, if you're unavailable for whatever reason, then they can basically bring your deposition in and admit it as evidence if you are unavailable. But it's pretty strict on how you're unavailable. It's not just like, well, he's playing golf today, he couldn't be here. It's not like that. I mean, you have to be dead. So you don't want to be unavailable for the
most part. No, I don't want to be unavailable then. I'm sleeping with the fishes.
Yeah. So that's depositions. And like I said, you can make objections, things like that. And they can get a little heated sometimes too. And there's some funny videos out there I've seen on the internet. People with depositions where attorneys get in screaming matches and things like that. And they can be video depositions too, but usually they have to be noticed separately. But for the most part, they're usually just transcribed by a court reporter. They're not usually recorded.
I can understand the screaming matches. A couple of the ones I was in got pretty contentious.
Yeah. There's some interesting attorneys out there that like to take liberties with politeness.
Well, and they try to, I don't know whether they try to get you mad to say something that you probably shouldn't say or what. But I know that there were times where, you know, they just dig away at you and it's like, hey, look, I'm answering informations about this other guy. I'm not the one that we're doing this on.
I had one deposition where I knew this attorney was like just not a very nice guy for the most part. And he had tried to intimidate some other witnesses by being real aggressive and whatnot. And he handed my client a piece of paper and asked him to look at it. Well, common courtesy says you give it to the other attorney first and let them look at it. And then you hand it to your client. Well, he was trying to be all whatever. And so basically, he reached over to hand it directly to my client. I reached halfway across the table and ripped it out of his hand and said, I'll take a look at that first, thank you. And he said, I'd like the record to reflect that Mr. Meadows just ripped that document out of my hand. I was like, I did. That's because you didn't show it to me first. I appreciate that in the future. And so that was one of my favorite transcripts I have. I saved that one.
He ripped it from my hand.
Yeah. So those depositions are part of discovery and they're a major part. The thing that happens in almost every case are interrogatories. And interrogatories are essentially questions that you send over to the other party that they answer under oath. And these can be usually simpler things like their name, their address, their date of birth. You can ask some questions like, have they ever been convicted of a crime or felony involving dishonesty or anything like that? Because that's another reason you can impeach them later on. Just basic questions. And people can object to those interrogatories too. They can say objection, overbroad, ambiguous. That's always my favorite one to put down. I don't know what that means.
But those aren't done in the room with a recorder, right? They just send you the questions and you fill them out on your own?
Yeah, they fill them out on their own and then have them notarized and send back.
So there's somewhere on there you're signing that these are true to the best of your knowledge or something.
Yeah, pretty much. And then they're limited too, so you can't send like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. I don't even know what the rule is right now as far as how many you can send. It's usually, I think it's like around 20 or 30 or something like that. And if you can send more, but usually you have to have
permission from the court.
Yeah, leave a court to do it. Or you can go ahead and serve them on them. And then basically, if they object to it, then go to the court then and say, hey, here's why I'm doing more. Because there's a different reason why I'm sending them. You can't just keep bombing somebody with them. So I like to always label mine, like I'll say initial interrogatories. And then if I have more, then I'll say like
subsequent.
Well, no, I'll say like contingent interrogatories. Oh. And then so if there's something that came up later, I'll say supply what evidence you have that supports your contention that blah, blah, blah. So it's a different kind of interrogatory. And so if I ever go in front of a court, I can be like, oh, well, this is a different kind of interrogatory. It's not the same kind.
Right.
So, but those always fly back and forth. Those can be a pain to answer with your client because they're usually very verbose the way they're written. And your average layperson doesn't really want to answer them and they just put it off and you have to basically that's probably the wrong phraseology there. You basically have to force them to fill them out. Be like, come on, we gotta get this case moving along here. You gotta do these interrogatories.
Well, they probably have big lawyer words in them that you figure people are trying to trip you up because you answer it. You don't really know what the word means or how they're doing if you have too many. Like contracts, when you read some of these contracts, whereas and therefore and all this kind of stuff as you go through, wait a minute, what did that say? I don't know what I'm signing.
So now another thing is called a request for production of documents or things. And this is basically where it's just a list and you say, supply me all documents you have which you plan to introduce as evidence at trial. Supply me with all documents which you have that pertain to your tax year from 2013 to 2017 or something like that. You know, just different. Supply me with all bank statements you have from those years. Just different things like that. You're asking basically for documents that they might have. You can also link it together with the interrogatories too and say, supply me with a copy of all documents you relied upon while answering the interrogatories. So you can do that too. So it's basically you're just trying to craft answers or craft questions for requests for documents, which will help you with your case. And that's where you can kind of get really dumped on with a lot of documents if you're not careful and you're making more work for yourself than you want.
Mm-hmm.
Some of your clients have privileged stuff and you don't want to give it over. So you have to move for a protective order from the court or object to it saying it's privileged information. And you have to fight with the other side saying why it's privileged and why they're not entitled to it. I've had one case where I had to argue that basically what they were requesting was trade secret, that they were trying to get some sort of trade secret from my client by giving this information over. And the judge actually believed me on that one and said we didn't have to turn that over. So that was good.
I won't ask you if it really was or not.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was. I think it definitely fit the definition. I mean, I wouldn't put forth some sort of argument that I didn't think had some sort of merit.
You got to believe in it yourself, huh?
For the most part, yeah.
You can see it, you can be it.
Yep. Now, if somebody doesn't answer any of these questions or they don't show up, like the interrogators, they don't show up for depositions or they don't show or don't provide you the documents, then you have to do what's called a motion to compel.
Mm-hmm.
And basically this is where you file a motion with the court and say, hey, I sent over this request as we're allowed to do in the rule. And they did not respond in the time frames, which they were supposed to. And usually you have to certify that I've made a good faith effort to try to resolve it beforehand. Mm-hmm. And then you file this motion to compel, and then you go in front of the court, and the court will usually say, hey, Joe Schmo, lawyer, why didn't you answer it? And they have to explain to the court why they didn't answer it. And usually the court will say, okay, well, I'm going to enter an order compelling you to do it. So then they have more time. And then if they don't answer it then you get an order to show cause as to why they didn't answer it, and then they can be held in contempt. And there can be some pretty strong things that happen if you do not answer discovery. They could actually strike your pleadings in the most serious of it. So basically they'll strike your answer or strike your complaint. Basically you would lose the case because it's been stricken.
If they could smite you instead of striking you, that would be good too.
Yeah. I smote them. So
when you say you compel him, it makes me think of like an exorcism.
Yeah.
The power of Christ compels you. The power of Christ compels you.
It's pretty much that. It's like the power of the court compels you.
Put forth the documents. Yeah. Run out, you demon.
Well, there's some other more interesting types of discovery that we use as well. But I think there was another motion that might be before the court.
Yes, if it please your counselorship, we would like to approach the bench to pay court costs.
All right. Approach. Who do we have for court costs today?
We have our good friends at ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? Well, if you are and you don't, you need to find ZipRecruiter.
With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100-plus job sites with just one click. Then, their powerful technology officially matches the right person to your job better than anyone else.
That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them. In fact, 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within one day.
Now, I'm going to have to check my figures, but I believe that's 24 hours.
That is correct, counselor.
There's no juggling emails or calls to your office. Simply screen, rate, and manage candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard.
Now, find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results.
And right now, our listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free.
Free?
That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/appoint.
That's ZipRecruiter.com/appoint. One more time to try it for free, and free means no cost. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/appoint.
You won't be unhappy.
Or employee-less.
Employee-less.
Or unemployed.
I don't know. Now, some other discovery tools that you have in your toolbox, aside from the hammer and the screwdriver, is what's called a request for admissions. And basically, this is where you send over something to the other side and says, and this is almost kind of like your the power of Christ compels you, basically, admit that you were wrong. So basically, you send this over to them. And they have to basically deny it and come back and say, denied.
Well, I guess, yeah, so guys, oh, damn it, they sent us this. Now we have to admit we were wrong.
Well, it basically locks them into their position in the case, too, because that way, if they change it later on, then you can say, well, why didn't you answer at this point? And you can try to move for attorney's fees if they change their idea on that. Mm-hmm. But here's another tricky thing, too. Is if you don't answer a request for admission within a certain amount of time, guess what happens to it?
I don't know.
It's deemed admitted.
Oh. What you mean, whatever you said? I mean, I don't get it. What does that mean? It's deemed admitted?
Yeah. So if I say...
Oh, I see.
So if I say, admit you were wrong, Tommy, and you're like, I'm not even going to answer that.
Then that means you're wrong.
Then the court will say, then you make a motion to deem the request for admissions as admitted.
So that's like the old saying of your silence constitutes consent.
Pretty much, yeah. So it's a pretty good tool. I like to use that one as well. Now, there's kind of it's frowned upon when you... So basically, if you write in the complaint
that... always makes me think of that Friends episode. Yeah. That's frowned upon.
If you write in the complaint that Tommy Smurl was at fault when he caused his Nissan Pathfinder to collide with my car. And so that's in my complaint, saying that's what you did wrong. And now I send you a request for admission that says, admit that you were wrong when you caused your Nissan Pathfinder to collide with my car. So that's almost like a completely conclusory type request for admissions. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of frowned upon to do it that way.
Well, I mean, all you got to do is say no and send it back, right?
Right. But it's kind of silly because, like, that's the whole point of the case. So really, you should frame it as, admit you drive a Nissan Pathfinder. Admit that you own a Nissan Pathfinder on this and this date. Do you see what I'm saying? So basically you're laying the foundation for the fact that these issues are kind of...
I'll say that doesn't sound like earth-shaking information, though, towards the case.
No.
Well, yeah, I own the car. What's your point?
No, but those are all things you have to establish.
Oh, okay.
I mean, if I'm trying to sue you for some sort of automobile accident, I'd have to say, you know, you have a Nissan Pathfinder, right? And you're like, mm-hmm. Yeah, and you're driving on this day, right? And you're wrong when you did it, right? Well, no. Okay, just try that one.
Try to slip that in there. damn, now we got to really figure this out.
He tried to Matlock me. Now, discovery does have kind of a time frame for it. It usually starts right when you file the complaint. You can go ahead and start firing off those discovery requests. But what happens is you get what's called a trial order, and the trial order comes from the court. And what it will do is it will have a discovery cutoff date, which basically says discovery will proceed until this time. And usually the date when it's cut off is, you know, a couple weeks before trial. So you're not doing discovery while you're actually at trial. And the discovery cutoff date is actually usually right around the same time you're supposed to have a mediation cutoff date, because every civil case is going to have to be mediated. That is pretty much fact. You have to go to mediation because the courts want you to try to resolve it if you can, so they don't have to deal with it. So, now,
does a mediation involve any kind of judge, or is that just the clients and their lawyers sitting down and trying to come to a conclusion?
Well, it's the clients, their lawyers, and a neutral third party who's not really there to make a decision, but he's there or she's there to just try to facilitate some sort of agreement between the parties.
What kind of a person are they, though? I mean, are they a judge? Are they a lawyer? Are they a certified arbitrator? I mean, that person?
In Florida, I'm a Supreme Court certified civil mediator. So I've been a mediator before.
So they're usually other lawyers? Is that what you're saying?
They're usually other lawyers. They can be retired judges. And for certain cases, they can actually not even be lawyers. They can just go through the whole class to become a circuit civil mediator.
Oh, really?
Yep. But I will tell you, I've had a couple that were not lawyers that were circuit civil mediators, and there was one that was okay, but for the most part, I really like to have my mediator be a lawyer or a judge.
I would think that's just like some of the magistrates we have.
Yeah. So,
I mean, they have no training in it, but they're making decisions about people.
Well, I mean, the magistrates go through that week-long class or two-week-long class.
Oh, boy.
And then I think as they progress on the job, I think they learn a lot more too.
Well, take that week or two long class and compare that to the time you spent becoming a lawyer.
There was a lot of blood, sweat, and tears going into that.
That's what I'm saying. That's, you can't really compare their knowledge then at the end as compared to a lawyer's.
Yeah. And it's always a good idea to have the discovery complete as you can for mediation, because that really gives each side a good picture of what the other person's case is. And as a mediator too, you might say, okay, well, what have you learned about their case from discovery? You know, tell me what you think. So
you learned your lesson? Are you willing to say you're sorry?
Do you want to say uncle? So I really like being a mediator, and it's probably something I want to get back into at some point.
You know, they probably think sorry seems to be the hardest word.
Sorry?
Yeah.
Yeah. I want an apology in writing that this person was wrong and that I am right.
Well, I was actually referring to Elton John.
Oh, that went right past my...
That's all right. Some of your movie references go right over my head, and I've been accused of skipping them, but it's just that I didn't understand them. So that's from my music repertoire. That's your Tommy's Music Corner there.
Tommy's Music Corner? Yeah, I've been in Tommy's Music Corner in a while.
Yeah, I was asked to revisit that on Facebook.
Come on back to Tommy's Music Corner.
I had to list a few there for them. They wanted to know some other groups that I had to go back and listen to that episode to know what they were talking about.
Like, I have no idea what you were talking about.
That was at Christmas Spirits v. Donuts.
I will say, when I worked for a larger law firm, going through discovery was part of my job, because that's usually what the younger attorneys get to do, is like, here, sort through this discovery.
Sort through these 50 boxes to find that one bit of information we're looking for.
Oh, and it was not fun. I mean, it's just what you do. But now that I'm out on my own, and every time I bill an hour, it actually... I see what
money
that means.
Yeah.
I'm like, discovery is a necessary part of this process. We mm-hmm. need to do a thorough job.
And you can't wait till you have flunkies of your own to do it for you, right?
No, I'm my own flunky at this point. So
that's pretty bad when you're your own flunky.
Now, it depends. If you're doing it on if you're the defense attorney, then yeah, you're loving it because you're getting paid by the hour. Mm-hmm. If you're a personal injury and you're doing it on a contingency basis and you're essentially working for free,
yeah,
discovery is still not fun.
Right.
But it's got to be done, though, because that's how you make your case.
Sure.
So now, I mentioned something about if something might be privileged, you don't actually have to turn it over. There has to be some sort of privilege you can assert, like, well, if they're not looking for medical records, you can say,
doctor, patient.
Yeah, or something like that. If it's communication between an attorney and a client, it's attorney-client privilege.
How about a pastor and a person that came and talked to him or something like that? Do pastors have some kind of privilege?
Now, you know, I don't know. I think I know that's...
I've heard that debated before.
I know for a fact that it was at some point, but for some reason, I feel like that has been eroded. And I don't know
like
why.
A Catholic priest hearing confession, if somebody came in and confessed they murdered somebody, they would need to turn that information over?
I believe so, yeah. I mean, generally what
You're supposed to be talking to God when you're in that box.
The whole
God
process
wouldn't turn you in.
About these privileges is that you have an expectation of privacy, and socially we want people to basically have this outlet where they can be completely honest with these people and not have to worry about that conversation being turned over to somebody else. So, But I think for the most part, I don't know. I'd have to look at it. I'm not even certain. It's not one that's ever come up actually in my practice. I've never had to try to assert some sort of priest privilege or whatever.
Pope privilege. There's got to be a Pope privilege. You can't compel the Pope to have to tell you stuff because he knows a lot. God tells him stuff.
Yeah.
That's how he gets to be the Pope.
One of the other privileges is out there is like spousal privilege too, because you generally can't compel a spouse to testify against the other spouse. And I've had that come up before sometimes, but the privileges are kind of few and far between. They're not as frequent as you would think they are. And if you have any documents or anything that basically is privileged, you have to maintain what's called a privilege log just so you can identify it to the other side and be like, here's what, you can't just pretend like it doesn't exist. You have to essentially say, it does exist, and it's in this log, and you can't have it. And then you get to go to the court and argue as to why they can't have it. So,
and you got the other side argues why they think they should have it.
Exactly. Hmm. So,
now is a spousal one? Is that like very strict in that they actually have to be married? Because like, what if a couple lived together for 10 years and cohabitated as man and wife, but weren't actually married? Could they not then plead spousal privilege?
I don't really know. I'm just kind of shooting from the hip here, but I'm going to go ahead and guess no, because there is no such thing as common law marriage anymore.
Okay.
It's pretty much been abolished in all states, and that would kind of be very similar to common law marriage. So,
okay.
One other thing that lawyers use whenever they're trying to get not medical records in general, but just records, a lot of times to like a hospital for medical records or other places that have maybe need like electric bills or things like that, you will serve them what's called a subpoena duces tecum.
Duces tecum?
Mm-hmm. Duces tecum. And basically, it's Latin, as you might have guessed. Basically means, bring it with you. That's what that means.
Is that like BYOB?
Yeah. Well, it's basically you're saying, here, I want you to bring these documents. I'm going to subpoena them duces tecum. And a lot of times, they're what's called mail-in. So basically, you send these out, and then whoever you subpoenaed basically just has to mail the records to you. They don't actually have to show up and serve them. But you would say, you could do take a deposition, subpoena duces tecum. So I'm going to take your deposition, subpoena duces tecum, because I want medical records, or I want some sort of records you maintain for your business. And then you could just send them in lieu of appearing at the deposition. Or you could actually appear at the deposition and be like, I brought these documents. I brought them with me as directed. So,
well, could you make the stand, I'm here and I'll answer questions about them, but I'm not going to turn them over to you?
No, because basically bringing them is what you're supposed to do, not answer questions about them.
Oh.
And usually documents speak for themselves, not somebody trying to interpret them for you.
Okay.
So, but that's another tool that's in the toolbox there. It's a pretty common one, actually. Even though it's got a weird name, it's very common.
Duces tecum.
Duces tecum. That's pretty much discovery right there. I mean, It's one of the linchpins of our civil process, and it takes up a large amount of time of it. And I would say that a lot of your pre-suit motion practice is based around discovery and people not doing discovery properly and trying to compel people to do discovery and things like that. That's for the most part what you're kind of litigating with before you actually go to trial. It's all about fighting over information, essentially. Mm-hmm.
I found two things when I was getting ready for this that I thought were interesting. One was in several of the things that they referred to discovery, they talked about Brady v. Maryland, how that set the basis for a lot of the discovery things. And that
right.
In that, it kind of was easy to understand why they were saying it. They said that Brady and another guy were on trial for murder.
Mm-hmm.
And Brady had contended, well, yeah, I was involved, but I didn't actually pull the trigger. The other guy pulled the trigger. Well, in the other guy's confession, he said, yeah, we both were there, but I'm actually the one that killed him. They withheld the other guy's confession so they could try both of them for murder.
Right.
So the prosecution withheld that. So it went. And of course, it finally came to light, I guess, during the punishment phase when they brought that out and they said, you know, you knew about this and you had to do it. And they were saying, well, it didn't matter. He was still guilty. He was involved. But they said, well, it affects the punishment phase of it. So they established new laws concerning that based on that trial.
Yeah. And that's only in criminal. So that really doesn't apply to civil at all.
Right.
But that would be considered if you don't turn, if the prosecution is not turning over something that is exculpatory. Mm-hmm. And by exculpatory, I mean, tends to prove the defendant's innocence, then that is considered a Brady violation, and that's really bad.
That Brady violation, and that's where that term comes from, is that Brady v. Maryland.
Yes, absolutely. So, and that's why in your discovery request, when you do it in your criminal thing, you basically say, when you're requesting it, you want any information or anything that might support your client's innocence. So basically, they have to provide that to you. It's a formal request for it. Now, they should turn it over anyway, even if you don't do a discovery request. Mm-hmm. But you should always do a discovery request anyway.
The other one that I thought was interesting is because of the field of work that I'm in.
Okay.
And it's the Zubilaki rulings. Now, I'm probably saying that wrong.
I've never heard that name before in my life.
You never heard that?
No.
Well, here's what it has to do with. When Laura Zubilaki first brought her employment discrimination lawsuit to her attorney in 2001, neither of them thought this case would make history. But here's what it boiled down to. Zubilaki didn't get a promotion she thought she had earned at Global Financial Services, UBS. So she filed a complaint with Human Resources and suddenly found herself at odds with her bosses. And it's a fact pattern that could describe hundreds or even thousands of employment discrimination lawsuits. Turns out that they couldn't have been more wrong about this one not being unique. Said that the 2004 ruling, nicknamed Zubilaki 5, because it was the fifth of five pretrial decisions, became a landmark in many respects. It helped propel the e-discovery industry into the stratosphere, turning it into one worth billions, while setting up litigation rules that are still brought forth over 10 years later. That decision changed the way that companies and lawyers approach electronically stored information. In the initial filings, when they filed for discovery, she asked for all the emails concerning her employment, you know,
right,
and things that took place between her and her superiors, and the Swiss-based firm produced only 120 emails in response to this request. Well, it helped that Zubilaki understood the rules of how this worked in preserving information on her own. She was able to supply 400 emails of her own that she had concerning it. So at that point, the discrepancy between she had 400 that were just on her end, mm-hmm, and they only had 120 that would have involved several more people.
Yeah.
They knew that something was up. So said that Zubilaki says she pushed her lawyer and her legal team to search for the emails, even as UBS claimed they didn't exist. She understood how the information was created and believed it was somewhere that they just had to find it. So as it dragged on, one of the defenses that UBS used to try to circumvent the thing is they tried to tell him, well, all that stuff is on backup tapes, and it's going to cost you $300,000 if you want us to, you know, reload those backup tapes to get it. Well, first of all, if you know how backup tapes work, it wouldn't cost $300,000.
Yeah.
So that was just a ploy to avoid it. So what it came down to is they were being, it was bordering on what they would call an adverse inference instruction, which basically says, if you don't produce this information, then we're going to assume that everything that they say is missing is correct, and that you're not producing it on purpose, because they say basically they were displaying a pattern of not cooperating.
Yeah.
That it was clear to the court. And the reason there were five rulings is they said the first three Zubilaki decisions dealt mainly with cost and whether or not UBS could force Zubilaki to pay for extracting the data. And then Zubilaki 4, it was clear that some of the data was unrecoverable, and the judge had to decide how to proceed. She declined to impose adverse inference at that point, whereby a jury would be instructed that any evidence UBS failed to provide would have been beneficial to Zubilaki. So in practice, an adverse inference usually ends the litigation because it's like overwhelming to the other team that, you know, you're wrong on this.
Yeah.
Well, by the time that Zubilaki 5 rolled around, the judge no longer was accommodating to the defense. During the additional depositions that came about as a result of Zubilaki 4, Zubilaki lawyers found there were even more emails and documents that UBS had either deleted or failed to preserve. So they've came up with all these ones, and then other times they presented documents that they said they didn't have anymore, and then a couple years later, they came up with them.
Yeah.
So at that point, then that Zubilaki 5 ruling came down, and she ended up winning $29.2 million in her trial because of what they said they, you know, how deceptive the company had been. So this basically, it set the rule for going forward on that. But the interesting part was when they asked the jury afterwards, you know, what was the biggest influence to you? They said it really wasn't that adverse inference or anything like that, that everybody thought was the most damning to them. They said what it really was the testimony, because Zubilaki had all her emails and could recite things from these emails, and not from memory, because we're talking about several years after the fact,
right,
when it came to trial. She could refer to these and be accurate in what she did and consistent. The other ones, they were getting bits and pieces of information. And like at one time, one of them had said, no, we were talking about getting rid of her before any of this ever came about. Well, then when these emails suddenly came to light, they were talking about it after they had been notified about her filing the you know, discrimination suit.
Yeah, so it was like retaliatory.
Yeah, and so then it looked like they were all lying. So they said that they actually would have done their clients better if they had gone ahead and produced all these, so they at least could have been consistent in what they were saying and speak from these, you know, the facts.
Yeah. That's one thing that juries will do. They'll forgive you for making a mistake, but they will not forgive a liar.
Yeah. So they had painted it that way, and it really worked against them. But, you know, UBS is a big company. They're good. And there's your corporate greed. And they, you know, they tried to stomp on this poor woman, and she stood up to them and, you know, came out the victor to it. And it established a whole new industry, e-discovery. I mean, there's businesses that specialize in, you know, how you properly handle electronic data now. And that's something, as a business, you now have to be conscious of how you store it and how you use it and what you do with it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's going to bring us to
Legal Briefs.
Legal Briefs is the part of the show where we go over different terms we talked about over the course of the show. Usually it's me asking Tommy if he can remember what it means. We got all kinds of tools there. We got ripe terms today.
Well, you know, you want me to see if I know about tools? Well, you know what they say, it takes one to know one. So I'd be pretty good at this.
So I don't even know where to start. There's so many. What is a deposition?
A deposition is when they ask you questions and you are in a room with a lawyer and a court reporter, and you're sworn in, and it's under oath testimony that you're giving.
That's right. You've been deposed before.
I've been deposed.
I'm throwing some softballs here to warm you up.
That's right.
Interrogatories.
Those are a series of questions that you send somebody, and they could be initial interrogatories, and there could be subsequent interrogatories, but they called something else. But they ask questions, and the first ones are basic questions, and then maybe you found something in there that you needed more questions, and that's why you have the later questions.
Yep, and they're notarized, so they're basically like
they're notarized that you're telling the truth.
Yeah, so you can use them to impeach somebody if they answer something differently later on in trial. Request for admission.
Request for admission, that's when you ask a guy to admit that they were driving this car, or admit that they owned it, or admit they were wrong.
Yeah.
Even though that's frowned upon.
Admit you owe us money.
Admit you're a ne'er-do-well.
Admit the power of Christ compels you. The motion to compel.
Motion to compel means, hey, judge, he hadn't answered my questions. Make him answer them.
Yeah, that's it.
Compel him to answer. Compel him to answer. Throw holy water on him.
Request for production.
Request for production. Did you go through that one? I don't remember that one. Request for production.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I do that of my employees sometimes.
I'll give you the full name.
Yeah.
Request for production of documents or things.
Oh, well, that means saying we want all your documents that pertain to like your 2013 taxes or something like that. So right. any documents that pertain to this particular subject, we want you to produce them.
What is your request for production for employees?
Do more.
We do something.
Get all those boxes up there.
And then this one you knew was going to be coming. Subpoena duces tecum.
Duces tecum. I always want to be like the guy on that beer commercial. It kind of sounds like that, because it sounds like Dos Equis or something like that. I don't often drink beer, but when I do, it's Dos Equis.
I don't often subpoena, but when I do, it's Dos Equis.
That means bring it with you.
Yep. And that's how you usually send those to third parties and ask them for different kinds of documents, information that is germane to your case. So and they can either mail it in and send it to you, or they can actually appear and bring it with them. So,
but bring it with you, dude.
Well, I think that's going to do it for all the terms I have.
I batted 100 on that one.
You did. You knocked this discovery out of the park.
Well, I discovered the truth.
You did. Maybe you should come to my office and do my discovery for me.
Well, how much do you pay?
Nothing.
So then I'd be the flunky's flunky. That's pretty low down the totem pole when you're the flunky's flunky.
So what do you think about discovery? Does it seem interesting to you?
It does, but it also seems like another tangled web to get into as well.
Well, I will say for civil purposes, in a lot of cases, discovery, you either win or lose your case during discovery.
Well, I can understand that. Yeah, so, if good lawyers probably really know what to ask for, depending on what the case involves. If you don't really know what to ask for, don't ask for the right things, you can really handicap your client.
Oh, yeah. And it's very important, too, in general, to know the rules of procedure as well, and know those kind of inside and out, so you can kind of navigate your way through these different things and know what you're supposed to do and what you're not supposed to do, like how many days you have to answer things, how you're supposed to answer them. Because, you know, when you answer interrogatories, you don't file the interrogatories. You just basically serve a notice that you answered them.
Mm-hmm.
So there's different little ins and outs that, you know, if you don't know what you're doing, you're going to screw up. So,
and you could actually hurt yourself by asking for too much. So you need to make sure that you're very precise in what you ask for, because if you get flooded with a whole bunch of crap, then you got to sit there and dig through it.
Absolutely. That was one mistake I made. I was a second-year law student working for this lawyer, and she said, she goes, hey, why don't you, she didn't want to do discovery, so she's like, hey, flunky, why don't you figure out what documents to ask for? And I was like, okay. So, like, I basically...
I'll ask for everything.
Pretty much. I was like, well, I can see where that might be.
Why they didn't think of that.
Yeah. So I asked for like, something ended up being like 1,500 pages of crap. And I was like, I'm not going to make that mistake again.
Well, I did this to myself. That's the worst part about it. Yeah. I don't have nobody to blame but me.
I quit that job soon thereafter. So
I would have quit after the pages came.
Like, oh, I asked for a lot. Oh, I need to take a leave of absence.
I'm not feeling well.
Yeah. I'm going to focus on school. So, yeah, discovery, it's interesting. Either love it or you hate it, or you're indifferent about it, which that covers pretty much everything.
Or you don't get that channel.
Yeah.
Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Doctor, Lawyer, Indian Chief.
And thanks to the McElroy Stable of Podcasts for the use of their recording studio. Their podcasts include Mabim Bam, Sawbones, and Still Buffering, as well as many other fine offerings. And please, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you liked us. If you didn't, well then, not so much.
You're not supposed to say that.
You always edit that out though, right?
Usually. This has been Court Appointed. I'm Mike Meadows, your co-host. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurf. And I'm just a dude.
Thanks for listening.